500 years and counting. Survive in the genocide they call colonizing my turtle island. What is
all I know, I keep making this fooler. I stay protected, that blue steel will do ya. Yeah, my chick bad and I keep the kill bill, yeah. Born and raised, thoroughbred trio. Let's go, let's go. All
I know. Hey, this is Randy West coming from OSP at our annual Yehusasa Talent Show.
Yeah, let me be clear about it, I got it. You way out of pocket, go bring this shit here. Getting body back, tipping the bottle back. This is
this your boy TJ down in OSP, man. I'm telling you, rap music, you know what I'm saying, R&B. You know what I'm saying, got a little bit of comedy up in there, man.
Y'all make sure y'all tune in June 25th at 6:30 p.m. Check out some of these guys from the OSP prison doing their thing, you know. We got a lot of acts and a lot of talent in here to share with the world. So just make sure y'all check that out. June 25th, 6:30 p.m. Prison Pipeline, y'all.
Tell me, baby, are we gonna let the elevator bring us down?
It's 9 o'clock. You're listening to KBOO Portland. And here's what we've got coming up for you this morning on KBOO. First, it's Making Contact, today examining the criminalization of black girls, their intricate lives being highly judged by teachers, administrators, and the so-called justice system. At 10 o'clock, it's Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary, and then at 10:15, it's Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein, as usual. And at 11, the Food Show reports on the threats posed by Big Dairy in Oregon. And we thank you, KBOO members, for your generous support, and we urge listeners to KBOO who are not yet members to get involved. Stay informed. You know you do it here. And it would be really helpful if you went to kboo.fm and click on donate and become one of those members. Thank you. Now here's Making Contact.
This week on Making Contact.
What does it mean for our policies to reflect that Black Lives Matter, right? What does the school system need to look like in order to fully uplift that Black Lives Matter, right? And it doesn't look like, you know, threatening girls with suspension if they wear their hair in afros, right? It doesn't look like, you know, sending a girl home because it's 90 degrees out and she wore short shorts. It doesn't look like, you know, suspending girls for 10 days because they had a fight in the hall. It means that we have to think differently about how we respond to conflict, how we understand what these behaviors are, and the kinds of assessments that we do on the policies and practices, the kinds of training and professional development that we have in place.
On this edition of Making Contact, we'll speak with Dr. Monique W. Morris about her book, Push Out, Decriminalization of Black Girls in Schools, an examination of the experiences of black girls across the country whose intricate lives are misunderstood, highly judged by teachers, administrators, and the justice system, and degraded by the very institutions charged with helping them flourish. Dr. Morris, what was the genesis of Push Out, the criminalization of black girls in schools, and why now?
Thanks for asking that question. It has long been on my soul, the need for us to address what is happening with our girls in schools, and to specifically look at the ways in which black girls are vulnerable to criminalization, victimization, and contact with the criminal and juvenile legal systems. And so writing Push Out, with the subtitle, The Criminalization of Black Girls in Schools, was really about expanding the discussion about what most people understand as the school-to-prison pipeline to engage in our girls and young women, and to talk about some of the unique pathways that render them vulnerable to contact with the criminal and juvenile legal system, some of the conditions that take place in our schools and that impact their learning in a way that render them vulnerable to contact with the justice system. And so in many ways, Push Out is an extension of a conversation that I have been having since the 1990s, when I first started doing work on juvenile justice and young people who are in contact with the justice system. And this work, you know, I say in the first part of this book that this work was really coming to fruition at the time that I wrote the novel Too Beautiful for Words. Mm-hmm. And some may remember Too Beautiful for Words as a street novel that was inspired by the coups song Me and Jesus the Pimp in a 79 Granada last night. Mm-hmm. And the novel itself talks about prostitution, talks about revolution, talks about life and hustle. And in the process of going around and talking to young people about Too Beautiful for Words, I discovered many girls and young women who were in detention facilities, who had been pushed out, who had been marginalized in their learning, and therefore extremely vulnerable to underground economies mm-hmm. that rendered them vulnerable to contact with the criminal and juvenile legal systems. Mm. So this book, in many ways, is an extension of the questioning and discussions that I started in Too Beautiful for Words, but really from a more, you know, nonfiction, statistics and narrative driven discussion right. about the policies and practices that are making our girls vulnerable.
Now, you argued in the book that the school to prison pipeline framework has been largely developed from the conditions and experiences of males, and that it limits our ability to see ways in which black girls are affected by surveillance, zero tolerance policies, law enforcement in school, etc. How do you see such policies or law enforcement cultures in school and racial attitudes, biases exhibited by, say, school staff impeding black girls' educational successes?
There are many ways that it plays out in our schools. You know, the first thing I'll say is that much of how we understand this phenomenon is based upon the conditions of men and boys. As you say, I write that in the book. Mm-hmm. And that means that because the numbers of men are so and boys are so large, that we won't see girls in the same way. And the attention has really been on ways to circumvent you know, the criminalization of men and boys through various initiatives, all of which is really valuable,
right.
except that we're doing it in many instances to the exclusion of girls, and that's what's problematic. So when we talk about what's going on with girls, we tend to operate as if they are being criminalized in the same way as boys. So we tend to respond to their fights in the same way. We tend to understand how they're getting in trouble in schools and rendered vulnerable to contact with the justice system in ways that have largely been shaped by the experiences of males. We even construct a narrative around this quote-unquote school-to-prison pipeline in a way that reflects a very linear understanding of the ways in which kids are in contact with the justice system. It doesn't always play out with a citation on campus or a situation on campus that then leads to an arrest and or a contact with the law enforcement or the criminal legal system mm-hmm. From something that directly happened on campus. Sometimes it's about being pushed out of school and then, again, rendered vulnerable to underground economies that then make our girls vulnerable, or the relationships that they have with individuals who are in contact with the law that make them vulnerable, or their victimization histories, sexual and physical victimization histories that make them vulnerable. So these are the things that I wanted to tease out. For some, even it's about their gender expression and identity. And that's where we get into, or that's where, you know, our society has failed to critically examine really the latent ideas about black femininity mm-hmm. that render our girls vulnerable to contact or push out with the criminal legal system based upon how they express being a girl, or based upon how we read their behaviors, based upon how we think they might be too loud
okay.
or they might have an attitude or they're dressing too sexy. All these things that are placed in and constructed by our understanding of racial and gender identities that we rarely interrogate, and definitely don't do so in the context of student codes of conduct
right.
very rigorously. And yet, when we look at the statistics, again, we tend to see that black girls are disproportionately showing up along all the discipline categories. Mm-hmm. They're the only group of girls to be disproportionately represented among all of the discipline categories for which data are collected by the U.S. Department of Education. Oh, wow. And this is really alarming to me, because they're not a large proportion of girls in the student body. There's 16% of girls in the student body, but their representation among those who are suspended, expelled, receiving corporal punishment, in contact with law enforcement on campus are all exceeding that rate. And so what push out is an exploration of what could be feeding these statistics? What could be feeding some of these disparities? And how can we address them?
Okay, so all of what you said, I mean, I have like four questions, right? But I want to focus or go back a little bit when we think about zero tolerance policies. How do you see it, based on your work and your research, how do you see it exacerbating the problem?
Yeah. So zero tolerance policies, I'll say from the outset, you know, have not done a very good job of curbing violence and or creating structures of safety in school. Number one, I don't think safety can be implemented by individuals. I think safety is co-constructed between the student body and the caring community of adults that are in their environment.
Right.
Zero tolerance policies remove the decision-making ability of leaders on campus to respond to situations according to those individual situations. There are mandatory actions that are often assigned to specific behaviors, and they also don't provide us with the incentive to engage in remedies that are not punitive. And so we don't necessarily then respond to the root causes of the conflict. We end up responding only to the action and removing kids from campus or removing kids from their learning environment, which can be marginalizing, especially when the actions that are under scrutiny are subjectively developed. So based upon our ideas about someone's expression or our ideas about someone's identity, rather than whether their actions actually present a threat to safety, to the safety of children and adults on campus. Mm-hmm. So those kinds of things are the issues that I try to address in Push Out. But it's also really important for us to think through what this alternative educational space might be, mm-hmm. right? And to really understand that we're operating in a time that tends to prioritize punishment over repair of harm. And to me, that was deeply problematic. Because in all of the research that I have engaged in with the girls and in researching for Push Out, you know, just removing a girl from campus or removing a girl from the conflict doesn't resolve the conflict. And so it escalates. It escalates in community. It escalates in schools. And it doesn't do anyone any good.
Right.
There's one example that I include in the book that talks about zero tolerance policies and its particular impact on a girl in Brooklyn who shared that when she was in an altercation with a young man in her class, he was spitting spitballs at her, and you know, her reaction was to tell him to stop, as you know many of us would if somebody were spitting spitballs at you.
Right.
And she got in his face and she got loud and he punched her in her face, and she describes feeling like, you know, well, she describes being taken to the nurse, being escorted to the nurse with her friends, and then also being suspended because she went to a zero tolerance school where if you were involved in the altercation at all, whether or not you actually physically came to blows with that person, she never hit him back. He hit her. She went to the nurse's office. But because she was involved in the altercation, she also got suspended. And there were a couple of things that I share with this incident. Number one is this was the first of many suspensions for her, because what did she learn from that first interaction? She learned that the school was not necessarily going to protect her.
Right.
She learned that she was going to be suspended anyway. So for her, she interpreted that as, well, I might as well fight if no one's going to protect me and we're not going to have a real conversation about why I'm having this tension and conflict with this person, then I might as well fight. And she became a fighter.
And she also said it rendered her invisible.
Exactly.
Right.
And that's my argument, is that it renders, our, you know, when we talk about, well, the argument is that when we talk about the, you know, school to prison pipeline, quote unquote, and we give these statistics that only prioritize the conditions of males, that a situation like that would render her invisible because we would only see his engagement in this incident and not hers. And yet, this is not the only incident that involves boys and girls in conflict that could have been resolved much differently, mm-hmm. that could have, you know, been an opportunity for discussion, could have been an opportunity to engage in anti-violence and education. I mean, there are just multiple ways that this could have been resolved outside of suspension and removal from school. Mm-hmm. And it especially is important when you're talking about girls who have extensive victimization histories, who learn that that their learning environment is not necessarily a safe space for them. As it should be.
Mm-hmm. Today on the program, I've been speaking with Monique Morris, the author of Push Out, The Criminalization of Black Girls in School, the first trade book to tell these untold stories and expose a world of confined potential, and supports the growing movement to address the policies, practices, and cultural illiteracy that push countless students out of schools and into unhealthy, unstable, and often unsafe futures. It's important to note that Black girls represent 16% of female students, but almost half of all girls with a school-related arrest. Monique, one thing you say in the book is that poverty is one of the most daunting challenges Black girls face, and that they have far greater likelihood of incarceration than girls of other races, end quote. You also explore gender bias, classism, and Push Out. Why are these significant factors when examining the various reasons as to why Black girls are pushed out and disproportionately disciplined?
So one of the things I want to say is that Black girls are 16% of female students, but they make up about one-third, or they're just over a third of girls with a school-related arrest per the most recent data available. And there are a lot of conditions. You know, I approach this topic using a lens of intersectionality, right, a term coined by Kimberly Crenshaw to explore the need for us to examine multiple identities and the way that they interact with each other to create a set of conditions and lived experiences.
Right.
And so because my approach to this work is an intersectional approach, it was critical for me to examine all of these socioeconomic conditions, victimization histories, explicit and unintentional biases that inform how we understand Black femininity and how we respond to the behaviors of Black girls given our understanding of Black femininity. And the way in which, you know, there has been a deep legacy of discrimination and bias and misinterpretation of what it means to be Black and female in America really is not a separate issue than what we're talking about in schools. It's not a separate issue than the, you know, what we talk about when we explore anti-violence efforts, or, you know, when we want to critically examine the violence against women and girls and the impact that that has on their ability to engage in meaningful learning experiences. At the root of all of this is, for me, an opportunity for us to engage in, you know, I would say a constructive critique of all that we do to both facilitate and respond to the vulnerabilities of our girls. And talking about, you know, their conditions of poverty, talking about the ways in which our society has primed Black girls for their own victimization, talking about the legacy of slavery that plays out even still in how we read Black women's bodies and how we devalue those bodies and how we teach them to internalize this oppressive view of their bodies is all a critical part of this conversation that I hope Push Out begins to inspire people to take on. I don't want people to pick up the book and say, oh, well, you know, she handled it. That's what it is. You know, we're done with this. I really want this to be a launching pad for strategy sessions across the country where we begin to really explore how we respond to the victimization of our girls and how we will construct learning environments that really can protect them against contact with the criminal and juvenile legal systems.
And I want to explore that before we let you go, but you've said a lot. And one thing in particular is the behavior of Black girls, given our history. Reading the book, one thing that stood out for me is the conversation of Black women or Black girls being defiant, right? Mm-hmm. Being disrespectful, being loud, and the way in which we're being read or perceived by people who don't understand us culturally, right?
Yeah.
I mean, I'm being nice in that way, right? But when you think about it, you know, Sojourner Truth, or an Ida B. Wells,
That's
or
right.
Fannie Lou Hamer, or Harriet Tubman were all defiant.
That's right.
Right? So as Black women, Black girls, we've interpreted defiance as something that is not inherently bad.
That's right.
Monique, are these attempts to label Black girls delinquent or disrespectful simply an issue of cultural illiteracy, or is it far more complex and rooted in American racism?
I think it's both. Mm-hmm. I think that you can't necessarily identify or single out the root cause of this bias. I mean, ultimately, the legacy of historical racism and gendered racism is critical to this conversation. Mm-hmm. And the unique vulnerabilities that play out are important to this conversation as it pertains to the individual bias issue. The question of being outspoken and how we understand that in our society is absolutely rooted in, you know, historical legacies of slavery and historical legacies of oppression that are internalized by girls mm-hmm. and by the adults in their lives. And I don't think that it's always intentional for the adults to either render girls invisible or to be dismissive of their expressions. But I do think that we have a responsibility to engage critically in checking our own biases mm-hmm. and in better understanding how implicit bias informs the decision making that impact the lives of these girls. So in the book, I talk to a girl I call Malaika, who's from the Bay Area. And she talks about being outspoken. And she says, I'm just outspoken. They're always telling us to voice our opinions. But then when we voice our opinion, we're going to get in trouble. That's so irritating, is what she says, right? And I think it's important for us to, you know, engage in uplifting these kinds of narratives, right? These kinds of stories and these kinds of expressions that girls are telling us. We are, on one hand, telling them, speak out, be engaged. This is how you, you know, create change. This is how all leaders have effectuated change. No one effectuates change by being silent and being complicit, right?
Right.
That we engage and we confront, especially under conditions of oppression. And yet for our girls, we say they're loud. We say they're not doing it right, quote unquote. And we don't follow that through with a series of interventions or opportunities to teach our girls how to really apply their very valuable critique and read on American expressions of racialized gender bias mm-hmm. In a way that can be more constructive in their lives. So I include in the book, two appendices, one of which is a Q&A that does provide some opportunity to at least initially have some conversations with girls, with educators, and with the community of concerned adults that are interested in combating the push out of Black girls in schools. But I think that at the center of all of this really are those narratives, mm-hmm. is our dedication to those narratives and uplifting those in a way that can constructively inform our responses to their conditions.
One thing for me that I found really interesting, especially when we think about behavior of Black girls and the way in which it's analyzed from various individuals, this is something that follows us from our early development in educational environments all the way into our work environments as adults. And I was pleased that you were able to expose that through the use of various stories told and pushed out, and that this is a particular reality that Black girls and Black women face in this society. Right?
You know, it's so interesting you say that, because now that I'm actually talking about the book and engaging in conversations, that is a theme that's emerging across the country. Although the book centers at K through 12, or, you know, sort of pre-K through 12, many of the college students that I engage will come up to me and say, you know, I'm dealing with that right now, right? Or, you know, the professionals will send me a note saying, you know, I just got into that with my supervisor. And it is something that other scholars whose shoulders I stand on have tried to explain and tried to explore. And somehow we have yet to, you know, sort of traverse that threshold into a space where folks will clearly understand that our understanding of how to be strong and lead with conviction are not worthy of others' scrutiny and criminalization.
Mm.
And for, you know, girls who are vulnerable to push out, that is really a critical issue, is how we come to define, you know, their attitudes, how we come to understand their expressions. And really, at the end of it all, what I'm hopeful that people will take away from that conversation is that we have a lot more work to do to better understand in the public domain what Black femininity looks like for girls, and to respond to that not through a lens of judgment and punishment, mm-hmm. but to understand that these expressions, these acts of questioning are not an affront to authority, mm-hmm. but an expression of critical thinking.
Absolutely.
Right? We're listening. That's why we respond the way we do. We feel what's happening. That's why we are responding, right? And so I hope others will feel and listen so that they can respond also.
So that's one solution. I wanted to get your take as we wrap up. What are some other solutions in addressing the disparities, and what are particular methods or approaches parents, guardians can employ when confronting racially biased educational systems that is punitively more harsh on Black girls? And also, you're a mother of girls.
You know,
how have you been able to navigate that? You and your husband, how have you been able to navigate that reality for your own children?
Well, first, let me start with the first question, right, about, you know, sort of what my thoughts are on how we create an environment that's conducive to the learning of our girls, not to their push out. I say in the book that there are really four core areas that I would like to see developed toward that goal. In the book, I talk about the development of healing-informed responses to problematic student behavior. So really looking at restorative opportunities, restorative approaches to resolving conflict with girls, bridging programs for girls with a delinquency history. Really, we've got to re-examine the impact of the dress codes and look at some of those codes of conduct through a healing-informed lens, but also looking at what happens in the classrooms and schools. So look at the you know, the affirmation of education as a tool for social justice so that girls really clearly understand why they're getting an education and how it relates to their lives. Some emotional counseling that can be there for girls. College and career pathways. So in my work, you know, a lot of the girls, they want to learn. They understand that education is a critical issue for them. They understand the research that says that education for girls is a critical protective factor against involvement in the juvenile and criminal legal systems. But they don't still get why they have to do it or why they have to go if it's not a place where they feel safe. And so I think it's important for us to establish, you know, school-based opportunities to lead for Black girls, to really look at developing internships, having speakers come in that can make those connections for them so that they understand the value of what they're doing and how they're spending their day. And then lastly, I talk about responsive and debiased learning. So really looking at the integration of arts, really looking at ways to deal with the cultural relevance of the curriculum, the implicit bias training and professional development opportunities that might take place among the educators and other professionals in schools, so that we really construct an environment that understands that our girls are there, first of all, and they're there to learn. They're not there to be cute, right? And we need to understand that they are there and co-construct an environment with them that establishes that they're there for those reasons. And then in terms of parents, you know, that's actually one of the questions in the back of the book, in one of the appendices, that asks, you know, what do I say to my daughter to encourage her to go to school, or how do I begin to have these conversations about the possibility of some of the biased decision making against my daughter? And I think it's really important for parents to understand that we are our daughter's greatest advocate, but that we cannot do it if we are also walking in and sort of in a combative way. We can hold people accountable. We can be a fierce advocate without coming in to turn the school upside down, right? Now, that may be our intention, right? And we may need to do a little bit to challenge the institution to be accountable to the needs of our girls, but we've got to document. We've got to talk to our daughter. We have to understand the full scope of what's happening. We have to talk to the teachers. We have to talk to the school community, because understandably, a lot of parents, when you read some of the cases that are included in the book, or when you hear cases like the one most recently out of Chicago, where a six-year-old girl was placed in handcuffs for taking candy off of the teacher's desk because the teacher wanted to teach her a lesson, quote unquote, those kinds of situations are infuriating.
Right.
And you could absolutely see how a parent could come in and be ready to put the whole place in order. At the same time, we've got to be clear that when we come to correct, we have to have our pieces in order. So my recommendations are for there to be an intense amount of documentation, some discussions that take place, and some clear ways in which community can come together with a series of facilitated questions. And I include some of those questions, you know, sort of core questions that I think parents should be asking when they come to the school to talk about these kinds of issues.
Extremely helpful, by the way.
Good. Okay. Yes. But, you know, so clear questions that parents should ask, clear questions that the child may ask if she's old enough and feels empowered enough mm-hmm. to really begin a conversation. I am of the mind that we can resolve this problem. I really believe that. I don't think this is something that cannot be resolved. But I don't think that it's going to be resolved by policymakers alone. I don't think it's going to be resolved by educators alone. And I don't think it's going to be resolved by parents or students alone. I think we have to come together and have a conversation about the kind of learning environment we want for our girls and the kinds of community structures that need to be in place to facilitate their well-being. And only when we come together to have these conversations in a structured way will we actually see improved outcomes for our girls. And that's what this is all about.
Absolutely. And that'll do it for this edition of Making Contact. Special thanks to Dr. Monique Morris, the author of Push Out, The Criminalization of Black Girls in Schools. On the next Making Contact.
There are a vast number of women who are beginning to wake out of the long sleep that is known as cooperation of one's own oppression and self-denigration. And they are banding together to make the beginnings of a new and massive women's movement in America and in the world, to establish true equality between the sexes, to break the old machine of sexual politics and to replace it with a more human and civilized world for both sexes, and to end the present system's oppression of men as well as of women.
With so many reports of sexual violence and harassment scandals leading the news these days, one has to wonder where we stand as a country on issues impacting the health and safety of women and girls. During the 60s, the country experienced a vibrant feminist movement that insisted that women exist as equal beings, not beholden to standards set by their male counterparts. Fast forward 5+ decades later, women are still advocating for some of the same basic rights, as shown through the Me Too and Time's Up movements, advocating for the end to sexual harassment and violence against women. Today on Making Contact, we'll present the documentary, She's Beautiful When She's Angry, a reflection on the rise of women's liberation movement in the United States between 1966 and 1971. Produced by Pamela Bull, Elizabeth Driehaus, and filmmaker Mary Doerr, She's Beautiful explores the emergence of a political thought that challenged systems of patriarchy. This documentary provides important historical insight at a time when our country is experiencing regression around issues of reproductive rights, equity in the workplace, and violence against women.
Women's health care is being tossed around like a football. The argument has been over for a very long time. To have the right to choose. We should be mad. Are you mad?
You're not allowed to retire from women's issues. You still have to pay attention because somebody's trying to yank the rug out from under you. And that's what's happening now.
The feminists who are here tonight, do you not believe a woman's place is in the home, right?
As feminists, what we believe in is very simple, and that is the social, economic, and political equality of the sexes. Because the relationship between the sexes is, in fact, a political relationship. We're an oppressed group, and we have been through history. We have to.
If you do something as remarkable as changing the relationship between the sexes, everything is at risk, every possible idea. And many people don't like it, especially men don't like it. They're very threatened by it.
Women's Lib really is a lot of insignificant people that are really trying to gain their own interests and boost their own ego by making brash statements or being on television or what have you.
You're so oversensitive, Audie. Why are you so sensitive?
We don't like being so sensitive. It's not pleasant.
We don't like having to always be catching things. We'd rather they didn't exist. But as long as people are going to be insensitive to our position, we're going to have to keep correcting them because there's no other way to change the consciousness.
Women, given their educational status, can earn 60% of what men of the same education can. What that really means is that a woman with college education, BA, earns what a man does who has 3 years of high school. This is economic discrimination and exploitation.
Women as well as men told me I was wrong over and over again. Women are not oppressed. Or what does it matter? Who cares? You have a lot of influence. You were working against cultural norms. You're working against institutions.
How do you feel about women's liberation?
Woman's place is more at home than to advance herself too much.
Totally against it. I feel I don't know what they're being liberated from.
Many women protested that they like cooking and housework and catering to men. But I would argue with some woman who was being extremely defensive about the movement and then 6 months later would run into her at a demonstration.
Prior to the women's liberation movement, most women were conditioned to meet the needs and expectations of men. But the introduction of this new feminist thought allowed women to view themselves as full human beings, equally capable of defining themselves and deciding their own paths. As the civil rights movement dominated the world center stage, women weren't content with being excluded from the conversations of resistance and liberation. Their issues needed to be prioritized as well. Activist Frances Beale.
The Black Liberation Movement had come into its fore, and you're talking about liberation and freedom half the night on the racial side, and then all of a sudden men are going to turn around and start talking about putting you in your place.
If you don't want any trouble.
That was the contradiction in terms that we were no longer prepared to put up with. So 1968, we founded the SNCC Black Women's Liberation Committee to take up some of these issues.
A number of women felt that we need to go off on our own and focus on what we needed to do in our fight for liberation.
I was a graduate student at Berkeley. And one day I saw a little 3x5 card in the student union, and it said, a women's group forming. And these consciousness-raising groups spontaneously grew up in many areas of the country.
When I first heard about the women's liberation movement, I had two little kids under five. My connection with the world was, I felt, finished. During one of my crises of feeling that my life was over, I heard some young women talking about meetings they were having, and they were talking about women's liberation, and they gave the address of a meeting. So I went to this meeting, and there were these women talking about their lives as I had never imagined people could.
Well, you need to be specially trained to be a housewife. You get married, there's a whole new set of rules. We still have to look a certain way and be a certain way. But there's a whole lot more to do.
We went around the room, and people asked a very simple question. How would your life have been different if you had been a boy?
Why do you think being a woman might limit you as a human being, your possibilities, you know?
Welfare people and whatnot.
We challenged concepts of masculinity. We challenged concepts of femininity. We talked about skin color, how young black women would put cream on in order to make themselves light-skinned.
Suddenly, everything was up for questioning. Women did all of the family and housework and cooking, and the men got to make the living and get all of the attention in the world. Why was that?
Like, we don't even realize what goes on until we sit and compare with other women.
And we heard each other. We heard each other into speech. You could sense it, you could feel it, you could cut it with a knife, as they say. The room was electric with whatever was going to be shared.
So I said, I've had three abortions, and the last one was within the last year. And I started to cry because I suddenly understood that I wasn't alone, that what I had considered personal embarrassment was something that was part of this whole larger experience.
The big insight of the women's movement was the personal is political. Problems that you felt were happening to you alone probably were your fault. But if it's happening to other people, then it's a social problem and not just a personal problem.
The framing of women's oppression as a societal construct put all the daily personal challenges that women faced into a new broad context. For the first time, women were openly broaching subjects that generations before were too fearful to speak of. Women were demanding the right to control their own bodies and lives without permission from men or the state.
Thousands of women in the United States are hospitalized each year because of post-abortion complications. 5,000 of these women die.
I had a very good friend in high school who went away to college, and she subsequently had an illegal abortion and died. So within 3 or 4 months of going off to college, she was dead.
People tried to self-abort. My best friend took pills, and she had the miscarriage in the dorm shower with the turned on really hard, hoping the noise would muffle her cries of pain.
Some were able to find an abortion. Some had to have the child that they didn't want. All those kinds of experiences we discovered were universal. And abortion became our big unifying issue.
Women have a fundamental right to control their own bodies and to control their own lives.
Our bodies, our lives, our right to be decided.
Not since the suffragettes fought for the right to vote has an issue been more critical to women than abortion.
Somewhere around 1970, I went to an abortion rights rally in San Francisco. And it was a sea of white women, very few women of color. And someone grabbed a bullhorn and asked for the African-American women who were there to gather under a tree. And we decided that we would form a group called Black Sisters United. I was very glad that, you know, somebody called African-American women together and said, you know, maybe we have something to talk about that might be a tiny bit different from what's coming from the stage. And indeed we did.
I was invited up to Harlem to speak at an event around abortion. Remember, in the Black Liberation Movement, the big debate is abortion is genocide, women should have babies for the revolution. And I remember going up those stairs and my knees were literally knocking because this was a bunch of nationalists and I was really scared. I concentrated a lot about the deaths of Black women as a result of illegal abortion and how we should be able to choose when we want to have children. So I managed to survive, you know, some of the attacks. And on my way out, twice it happened. One woman said to me, whispered to me, "Thank God you speak up. Thank God you're speaking up." And another, as I was approaching the door, said, "Right on. Right on."
Dear brothers, poor Black women decide for themselves whether to have a baby or not have a baby. Black women are being asked by militant Black brothers not to practice birth control because it's a form of whiteys committing genocide on Black people. Well, true enough. But Black women in the United States have to fight back out of our own experience of oppression, and having too many babies stops us from teaching them the truth, from supporting our children, and from stopping the brainwashing, as you say, and fighting Black men who still want to use and exploit us.
It was very difficult for middle-class white women to have any conception about what was going on in communities of color. And those differences could have been in conversation with each other, but if there isn't even an acknowledgement that there's differences in experience and perspective, and the voice of one is used as the voice of all, then you have a problem.
That was during a period when Black women did not particularly identify with the women's movement.
Mrs. Norton, why are you a Black woman involved in women's liberation?
I'm involved in the struggle for women's rights because I believe women are disadvantaged. Black women are no less than white women. Indeed, Black women far more than white women. Women who have spent their lives working in other women's kitchens have a different kind of handicap than women who have been oppressed for their sex in other ways.
We were grappling with that idea of how do you integrate race, class, and gender. That's the reason why we had some reservations about the term feminism, because feminism was just seemed to be dealing with the female aspect of your being.
It's important to keep in mind that Black women are organized in their own organizations, in their own version of Black women's liberation.
In 1964, a friend mentioned that his sister was pregnant and nearly suicidal. Could I do anything about it? And I was referred through a series of connections to a doctor, asked him if he would perform an abortion. He said yes, and a few weeks later, someone else called and said they also were looking for an abortion. The word had spread. And at that point, I decided to set up a bit of a system. I was living in a dormitory at the time, and so I told people to ask for Jane. I could tell within the first minute what they were calling about, because there was a pause, there was a hesitance, there was a tension. Many were frightened, because three people discussing an abortion in those days was a conspiracy to commit felony murder.
Jane was this service that was established in Chicago that provided abortions when abortion was illegal. We would have women call us who were in need of the abortion service. And, of course, having Jane available without having to refer them to the mob was a godsend.
The group would take in the calls, and we would do counseling. Then women would be brought to specific houses on a rotating basis where the procedures would be done.
The service moved every day from somebody's home to somebody's home, which is quite amazing.
I joined the abortion service because I knew that women are sometimes desperate, and they are going to hurt themselves in order to end their pregnancies. When I began Jane work, a few dozen women a week were coming through. After about 6 months, there were at least 100 women coming through. Ultimately, one really good abortionist taught Janes how to do abortions with skill and care, and then those Janes taught other Janes. All of us were always aware that what we were doing was illegal, that we could go to jail. You might have to throw everything in your bag and run down the back stairs at any moment, but we understood that it was important work, useful work, necessary work.
What is the relationship of the movement to the whole question of motherhood and the affection of mothers for children and so forth?
It's about being able to have children if you want them and being able not to have children if you don't want them. And if you want to have your kids in daycare centers, if you want to work, then you can do that too.
In the women's movement, the myth was that we hated men, we hated marriage, we hated children. That's not right. The group I was in, we talked mostly about childcare being the absolute precondition for women's emancipation.
One of the earliest battles was for childcare. It's in Now's statement of purpose. We knew that women could not hold jobs and be promoted until society recognized its obligation to help take care of our children.
And I remember at some of the early demonstrations, those who had kids, we would bring the kids. And people would say things like, oh, we can't talk with you nursing the babies and stuff like that. And we would say, show us the daycare center. We'll be happy to bring the kids to the daycare center.
Feminists are accused of wanting women out of the home and leaving children come what may.
We proclaim that when we talk about $24 child care, we mean to have it now. 24-hour child care centers today.
After a great deal of work where feminists were in the leadership, we got close to having a real child care system.
In 1971, amazingly enough, the women's movement, the Congress, the Senate, passed a comprehensive child care act. Most historians don't even remember that. Forget about the rest of society. And President Nixon vetoed it. He said, we don't want to make our women like Soviet women. We want women to take care of their own children.
That was a tragic moment in history. And we've been paying for it ever since. It's one thing for women to pay the price. It's another thing for generations of children to pay the price as well. I can think of, frankly, of no more important issues that early feminists raised than educational child care.
Poor people, black women, women on welfare, are often sterilized against their will. I mean, that's been known to happen.
The same hospital that wants to sterilize the black women will not let a middle-class white woman be sterilized. If she says, I don't want to have any more children, they say, you have to
be crazy.
Be crazy.
You've got to tell
you
me
you have to
crazy.
Have a medical reason. You have to be yeah. sick. There has to be something wrong with you.
Those things are two ends of the same dimension. It's still the issue of control over one's body, right. Whether it's the right to have children if you want them, or the right not to.
In Puerto Rico, over one-third of the women on the island have been sterilized. That means over one-third of the women are never going to be able to hold a baby in their arms.
Women in Puerto Rico were used as guinea pigs, as a way of controlling the population. And then with that sterilization program being brought to New York City, we actively organized raising the consciousness about this. The Young Lords Party was dedicated to issues affecting Puerto Ricans in the United States. We were the first ones to begin to articulate an idea of reproductive justice. It's just as important for women in our communities to be able to have children, raise children that don't go hungry, have daycare, as well as have access to birth control and the right to a safe abortion. The kind of developing feminism that we had in the Young Lords was make very clear decision not to separate, to wage struggle internally with our brothers. The men had written this program. One of the points dealt with revolutionary machismo. What an oxymoron. We weren't having it. So we formed a women's caucus and made demands on the men in the organization. It was ultimately changed to, we want equality for women, down with machismo and male chauvinism. It was important that it's not just women making that statement. It should be men saying, yo, brother, that's really a macho attitude you're taking. You need to check your... And that's what happened.
You're listening to the documentary, She's Beautiful When She's Angry, a reflection on the rise of the women's liberation movement in the United States between 1966 and 1971. Produced by Pamela Bull, Elizabeth Driehaus, and filmmaker Mary Doerr. This is Making Contact. Subscribe to our podcast or sign up for updates by logging on to our website at radioproject.org. You can also join the conversation on Facebook and Twitter. Now back to the documentary, She's Beautiful When She's Angry.
One evening in my Tuesday night consciousness raising group, West Village One of New York Radical Feminists, Diane Crothers walked in with a newspaper, It Ain't Me Babe, from San Francisco, and said, there's an article here we all have to read. And it was a story about a woman in Marin County who'd been raped during a hitchhike. We read the article and we went around the room, and it turned out one woman, Sarah, had been raped. And the police said to her, who'd want to rape you?
A friend of mine was raped at knife point in her bed in off-campus housing. I went with her to the student health service, and she was given a lecture on her promiscuity.
It was very common in a courtroom to blame the woman for the rape. And rape was looked at as a crime that occurred because a man had strong sexual urges that he couldn't satisfy any other way. And it was only with the feminist woman that it came out that rape is not a crime of passion. It's a crime that expresses the urge to dominate.
People were not used to thinking of rape as a political crime against women. That was our slogan. Rape is a political crime against women.
I think the most profound thing that feminism did for me was to make me feel that I was capable of genuine freedom. Before the women's movement, I had my own work. I knew I wasn't going to live a traditional woman's life. I felt that I probably wasn't going to have children. And ultimately, I did have my daughter. And I think, were it not for feminism, I don't think I could have done that.
Right after I got out of college, it was November 2006, my mother passed away, and I got all of these letters and emails from her friends, her colleagues, all of the feminists that started the Women's Liberation Movement. And I started to realize that even though I was down with the word feminism, I didn't really know what it meant to me and to our generation. I think the sexism that we experience is a little bit more insidious, and it's harder to sort of point out and say, see, that's sexism. But I know a lot of young kick-ass feminists out there. They're blogging, they're out in the streets, they're organizing.
What are you doing when you're older and tired?
Stand up, fight back!
What do you do when you're older and tired?
Stand up, fight back!
The problem is rapists, and we need to address the problem. And let me give you a hint, it's not our clothes. It's not.
There's this new movement called Slut Walk that has now swept 70 different cities. And it was started by a young woman who heard a cop say about a woman who was raped, well, she was asking for it, she was dressed like a slut.
Believe it or not, people are assaulted regardless of what they wear. Some people who get raped are in burqas.
NYPD rape is a felony!
We created a revolution that we are still debating in our society. We're still arguing over many issues that women raised 40 years ago, like abortion, like childcare. We still don't have any childcare.
In terms of reproductive health, reproductive justice, we've gone backward in a big way.
If we can have order in the chamber so that the members can properly cast a vote.
The bitter lesson is that no victories are permanent. All our rights are like that. They're only as good as we maintain them.
This fight is not over. This fight is not.
Again, that's the documentary, She's Beautiful When She's Angry. Special thanks to the film's producers, Pamela Bowl, Elizabeth Driehaus, and director Mary Doerr. To view the full film, She's Beautiful When She's Angry, check out the Making Contact website for links. The Making Contact team includes Lisa Redman, Monica Lopez, Anita Johnson, Sabine Blazin, and Vera Tykolsker. I'm Anita Johnson. Thank Thanks for listening to Making Contact.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of SEMA, Sacred Dance of the Whirling Dervishes, Sunday, June 24th at 3:30 p.m. at the New Expressive Works in Portland. The SEMA ceremony will be presented by the Mev Levi Order of America to honor the mystical poet Jalaluddin Rumi. The mystical journey toward perfection is symbolized in this ceremony of whirling prayer directed by the Posnishan Jalaluddin Loras. The musical ensemble will feature the Ney, Odd, and Kudum, as well as vocals. Again, that's SEMA, Sacred Dance of the Whirling Dervishes, Sunday, June 24th at 3:30 p.m. at the New Expressive Works, 810 Southeast Belmont Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
It's 10 o'clock. You're listening to KBOO, KBOO Portland. Stay tuned for Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. And at 11 o'clock, The Food Show reports on threats posed by Big Dairy in Oregon. Stay tuned, KBOO Portland.
Noted author and editor Vijay Prashad on Kashmir and the assassination of his colleague, the noted editor and courageous journalist.